Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Podcast listeners around the world, you are listening to the Gravity Commons Podcast. This is the best podcast.
In the world.
With the name Gravity Commons. Oh. I just wanted to finish the sentence.
Caveat.
And so you found it. And we're glad that you're here and you're listening to us and we're able to chat in your presence. I'm joined by Ben Sternke.
Mm-hmm. And you're Matt Tebbe.
I am Matt Tebbe. And it's good to be together today. Ben and I are flying without Christy. So yeah,
pray for us.
Things go off the rails. That's
Christy's fault. Yep.
No, she doesn't.
It's Christy's fault for not being here.
It's not her fault. You can't behave, Ben.
Pretty sure it is.
We are chatting today on this episode of our podcast about a question we got from one of our Commons community members. If you aren't a part of our Commons community, it's an online platform. There's a free membership. There's a premium membership. It gives us a chance to chat and talk. It's like a I would describe it as a private social media platform with education, investing, equipping, formational elements to it. If you're interested, you can just go sign up for free and see the free parts. And if you want to support us, if you kind of roll your eyes every time you hear a commercial in the podcast and you're like, what can I do to not have commercials in our podcast? Well, you could support us. Mm-hmm. It's $25 a month for a premium membership. You get access to lots of great stuff. Anyway, that's all the preface to...
Can I just say, practically speaking, if you would like to sign up, podcast listener, I know you're not at a computer now. Most of you are listening probably in your car while you're working out, in your earbuds, as you're going out and about. But just remember this web address, gravitycommons.com/community. That's where you can go to sign up.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. Yeah. And we get messages. We have conversations there, and sometimes the questions are easy and answer, and we just kind of chat about them. And sometimes I'm like, boy, we could really spend a lot of time on this, and I don't like to type long responses. So I asked, let's call him Bob. I asked Bob, who asked this question, hey, can we podcast through this? And Bob was like, sure. So I'm going to read the question Bob sent us. And then, Ben, I'll throw it over to you for reflections and thoughts, but I thought it was a great question. It's about how to deal with an awareness of the ways we benefit from systemic injustice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's a question that all of us are becoming aware of, that it is a worthwhile question to ask, and also then wanting to find answers. So...
yeah,
I'm going to read this question, then Ben, you provide the answer. We'll be done in 3 minutes. Here we go. Bob says, I'm wrapping my head around mammon and how it works in our world and our life. And I listened recently to Matt go in depth on the Liminal Living podcast about mammon. By the way, it'd be great if we could link that, Ben, in the show notes. I'm not sure our community even knows that I went on the Liminal Living podcast and talked about mammon.
I didn't even know there was a Liminal Living podcast.
Yeah,
everybody's it's kind of a mouthful. Kind of fun to say, though. Liminal living.
He says he heard me talk about mammon on the Liminal Living podcast. He says, long story short, my wife and I are coming home after several decades overseas as missionaries. And we're transitioning back to the U.S., getting jobs, living with parents, and try to get to the point of buying a house. He says, Bob says, my dad has a piece of property that was his dad's after he that he bought with money from the GI Bill after World War II. Mm. He says, I'll receive the sale of that property sometime in the next few years, which is now worth around $50,000. That money can help us buy a house, be invested, or help our kids with college. The ability for my uneducated grandfather to buy a piece of land that was denied to other veterans because of their race is how mammon works, Bob says. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. Way to go, Bob. First, he says, the fact that this will come to me is an example of the privilege I hold, even if I don't see it or feel it much given our current economic situation. And two, What I do with that money can either participate in unjust systems that stands on the backs of oppressed and marginalized peoples, or I can use it and put it to work in ways that will lift up others and my family. So he's wondering, in his head right now, he's got all these thoughts of like guilt, reparations, mm-hmm. opportunity, and the responsibility that comes with privilege and opportunity. So he's asking for wisdom on how to navigate the complexities of inheriting unjust wealth.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, Ben, you got 3 minutes. If you could
All right.
take care of that.
Yes.
Now, what occurs to you, man?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that occurs to me is that there really are no easy or obvious answers to this. Even the way, I think I might even challenge even the way that Bob framed this to say that I can either like participate in this system of injustice and benefit from it, mm-hmm. or I can like do something else with it. And I don't think we actually, the lines aren't that clean for any of us. You know what I mean? Like, because we have to, in order to survive, we have to participate in the current like economy that we have. Like, we're all participating in injustice. Like,
the prevailing economic order.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, for me to buy clothes that I can afford to wear, I benefit from, you know, like global trade agreements that employ probably unjustly children, you know, women, like all kinds of like unjust situations, like the factories in China and Indonesia that make the clothes that I probably am wearing now, mm-hmm. that I don't know about, but I can't afford anything else. You know what I mean? Like so anyway, so there's a lot of that I think is probably one of the caveats that I would say up front. And I don't say that. I think that's where a lot of people stop and they're like, well, I guess we can't, I guess we can't do anything about it, you know? And
yeah,
so,
can I not stop, but can I pause and just explore it a bit with you?
Yeah, sure.
So I think what immediately occurs to me and other people's, other people, I'm sure, is, well, there is a way for you to wear clothes you can afford, you know? Uh-huh. You can figure out, Ben, how to, you know, responsibly source your clothing from places that make clothing. And maybe it means you go from 16 shirts to 2 shirts. Maybe you could afford just 2 shirts, or you could learn how to make your own clothes from, you know, from justly sourced cloths and threads, you know, fabrics, if you will. Yep. So there is a sacrifice you can make in order to do the thing you say you can't do. And I think when people choose not to make that sacrifice, they feel guilty.
Yes. Yes.
And you should too. No.
No. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. So
no,
hopefully you'll feel.
No, so you just named clothing, but we could talk about food. We could talk about houses. Sure. We could talk about cars, right? Mm-hmm. We could talk about lawn darts. You know, we could talk about toys, games, uh-huh. electronics. Uh-huh. We could talk about every tool or everything we buy, every consumer good. We could do that same work for, but most of us choose not to. And so I just want to maybe just sit in that tension for a bit and ask you, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. And that's what I mean by, like, we can't stop there, because I do think that's another way that we sort of slip into, I don't know, maybe it's like a binary thinking, a way of thinking about it from a binary perspective, is that once we start pulling on that thread, it does start to feel overwhelming really quickly. Like, the amount of time it would take me to figure out how to clothe myself justly. Like, all of a sudden now I don't have enough time to actually make money at my job. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? So there's all kinds of ways in which I do think we are conscripted into a political economy that does not give us, that's meant not to give us choices. Actually, you know, ironically, in the name of offering us many choices. And so there's a tension. There definitely is a tension there because there, you're right. There are things that we can do, but none of us can actually do everything that it would require for us to actually live a, you know, like a completely just life where we're not participating at all in any systems of injustice. And I think it ends up being a fool's errand to think that that's the goal, is just to extricate ourselves from the system entirely.
Yeah. Well,
what are your thoughts?
I think there's people that do that. I think there's people mm-hmm. that make that decision and do that. For instance, I learned recently from a Mennonite friend of mine mm-hmm. that there's a lot of people in her community who intentionally live below, I think it's the poverty line, mm-hmm. but it may be another income level. And they do it intentionally so that they don't pay taxes that are then spent on military machinery.
Right.
So they're pacifists mm-hmm. and they don't want any of their capital or agency or power. If you think of money as a power, which I think is important to do, mm-hmm. they don't want any of their capital or power to be used for something that violates their conscience. Mm-hmm. And the only, so they have two choices. One is they can just withhold taxes entirely and go to jail.
Right.
Or two, they can figure out how to not have to pay that tax, which I think there's an income level under which you don't pay that tax.
Yeah.
And so they willingly choose to live at that level in order to not participate in one,
yeah,
in something that they think is unjust.
Yeah.
But then I do think that you're right, that one of the ways that Mammon works is that it is so ubiquitous, meaning it is so normal. So the logic of Mammon, we'll talk more about this in a bit, but the logic of Mammon, the orientation of Mammon, what's important, what we value, what's good, what's obvious, what's common sense.
Yeah.
Is so ubiquitous that to extricate ourselves from participation in unjust things is exhaustingly impossible.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So sure. that's one of the ways that the sovereignty of Mammon is expressed in how difficult it is for an individual not to worship it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what you're pointing out is that the typical way we think about this is, well, it's exhausting to think about learning to make my clothes and then extricating myself from fashion or clothing norms and being mm-hmm. so weird that I have two outfits that I always wear
right. In
my social circles. And then in order to be consistent, I need to do that in these hundreds and hundreds of other economic choices I'm making with material goods that are produced in unjust ways. And then I realized that's a full-time job.
Yeah.
And I already have a full-time job.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you need one because the availability. Yeah. I mean, everything runs on money, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think the mistakes that people make, you know, that I've made, like sometimes that just immobilizes you and you're like, well, I guess it's no use. And you just, you know, go on living, you know, the way that you were. You sort of go along with Mammon's demands just because it feels, you know, incredibly discouraging and immobilizing to try to do that. And we sort of just, we let ourselves off the hook, so to speak, of actually discerning how to act with justice in very particular situations.
Yeah.
So I think that's why one of the reasons the question that Bob is asking is compelling for me is because it is a very specific situation for him. He's not saying like, how do I extricate myself from Mammon, M, but he's saying, I have this piece of land, you know, I have this situation where I stand to benefit.
Yeah.
And I want to think faithfully and discern what to do as a follower of Jesus. And so I think one of the things I would want to say is, you know, there's no way to extricate yourself in the abstract from all of these things at once, you know, to sort of maintain your own purity. I think that's sometimes the instinct that we have.
Yeah, I want to say more about that.
Okay.
Because I do think, in particular, white conservative Christianity or white evangelical Christianity is a purity culture writ large. Meaning often purity culture is used to describe like our sexual ethic, right?
Yeah.
And it shows up there, but I think it's bigger than just sex and gender
and
human relationships. I think what I mean by purity culture is that we have there's a strong sense of right, wrong, in, out, guilty, innocent, pure, impure. And part of the in-group identity is that we are the pure ones.
Yes.
And we aren't impure, and we know it because of X, Y, and Z, and we get to be the arbiters of who's pure and who's impure. So our definition of purity is the definition of purity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's an important aspect of this to kind of recognize, because I do think you can make a distinction between what does it mean to act in justice, you know, and to discern in very specific situations how to follow Jesus, how to act with in alignment with the kingdom of God. Lots of different ways to describe it. And then, but to what extent am I just feeling anxious about the fact that I know that I'm impure now, you know, like, so it's less about my personal, it's almost like one of the things that's easy to happen in these kinds of situations is that I collapse this whole situation into my own self-identity as pure or impure. And we think the goal might be for me to just feel good about my own purity rather than, well, what does that actually mean to act with justice in a practical way?
Yeah.
You know, well, in this situation.
I think the way that we frame our faith, the way that we can, the categories we have, you know, guilt, innocent, pure, impure, I think that they actually limit our ability to navigate questions like Bob's wisely.
Yes.
Because we can't figure out a way to be innocent.
Yes. There's no one answer that's obviously pure and innocent and morally unassailable.
Yeah, pristine. Yeah. So because that's been, and that's not, I'm not saying that Bob or you or I, this is a cognitive thing. I'm saying it's baked into our faith framework that this is super important to us.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so it's almost a subconscious thing. It's like a part of our operating system that runs, which is why then we go to kind of the making our own clothes from ethically sourced fabrics or forgetting about it.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing in between. We either buy clothes and we don't give a rip about how they're made or who makes them, or we, you know, make our own clothes and live in a commune, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so I think part of our religious framework prevents us from answering or entertaining or moving into Bob's question with creativity and imagination and faithfulness, because we just sort of throw our hands up in the air. You know, and this is where parenthetically you get some of the people who are just get angry at Bob's question, right?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't make a racist GI Bill. It's not my fault.
It's not my fault.
I don't hate black people. Right. I don't hate anybody that wasn't able to get a job under the GI Bill. So that's not my concern.
Yeah.
Right. And this is another part of our white evangelical apparatus that I think does us problems, which is, and Emerson and Smith talked about this in Divided by Faith, which is a book written over 20 years ago. It's going to, an eventual book list will come out that will help maybe you, listener, track along with the stuff that we're learning. I promise I'm working on that. But anyway, Emerson and Smith, they talk about free will individualism as a component or an artifact of white conservative Christianity. And what that means is that for white people in the West, and more particular in the United States, we put a lot of emphasis and focus on our own volitional choices made as individuals as sort of the center or the primary way that we can be moral and immoral.
Yes.
And Emerson and Smith identify that not to say that's not important, but to say that sort of that primacy or that supremacy of free will, I think they call it free will expressionism, that centrality of that actually then keeps us from understanding or appreciating or even being aware that sometimes what we intend doesn't comport with reality.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling, and it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
One example of how we are all connected and the choices that I make, you know, impact other people, which I guess it shows me that the responsibility can't just lie with me as an individual in the choices I make. I very recently talked with somebody whose life has been drastically impacted by trauma because of abuse. And this person, like, you know what I mean? Like they were lamenting the fact that because of this trauma, they can't actually choose the things that they would like, you know, to do. Like, you know, this person was saying, I'd love to go to church and not have my heart rate spike because my body is convinced I'm in danger here. Yeah. I'd love for that to be the case, but it's not, you know what I mean? So like my life is affected by, you know, the choices that other people have made. And I'm connected to that choice, you know, in ways that are not fair to that person, but they're very real, you know?
So a quick example of this too, is I prayed for somebody at our church, a congregant, and in praying for them, they're dealing with some mental health issues. And I shared sort of some of this podcast I listened to about medication for schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And in the podcast, it was about how the difference between how the EU prescribes medication for schizophrenia and how the US prescribes medication for schizophrenia. And quickly, in the EU, people take medicine for schizophrenia episodically, mm-hmm. right? So they'll take it when they have a break or they have a psychosis that that is present. But then when they aren't manifesting those psychotic things, they stop taking it. And in the US, you just take it all the time. And the podcast was basically saying that the EU studies have been done to show that the way the EU prescribes those medications, they have much more efficacy and people, they work longer and better for people than if you take them all the time. So anyway, I'm like just naming out loud this to my congregant. And then about a week later, they called me and they were like, hey, that comment, you sharing that really made me, I got really angry when you shared it. And they just shared about how important their medication is for their mental health issues and how in the past Christians have poo-pooed or downplayed the goodness or necessity of
pharmacological solutions.
Yeah, there we go. That's about the most cumbersome way to say that. I'm glad I found it. And I had two choices, Ben. My free will, individual, expressionistic, white culture wanted to defend my intent.
Oh, like the person was upset that you shared it or how you shared it? Like they were upset with you?
They were saying to me, like, in the past, Christians have downplayed medications. And when you said this, I see. Like that, I got angry because I feel like I've had to fight for how good and necessary these medications are and how they've actually saved my life. And I felt the free will and individual expression is the way it shows up in like that conversation is for me to defend my intent. Well, I had no intention of telling you this wasn't a passive aggressive shot that you should take fewer medications. Right. And so, but in doing that, what I've learned is that I end up invalidating the way they're feeling.
Yeah.
And separating my intent from my impact.
Yeah.
Which is not loving the person who experienced harm. It's loving myself to exonerate myself from the harm they experienced.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I've had to learn the hard way that is not loving.
Yeah.
It's not Christian.
Yeah.
That's an example, though, of where that shows up in my life, even though I didn't say that, even though I thank them for telling me that, I validated their feelings. I tried to do that work that I now know is vital. In the moment, it still lives in me to come back to like the solid ground of my good intentions.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So all this to say, this is a very long, a very long appendix, I guess you could say, to say that we have a problem recognizing that we can be complicit or culpable, in some ways responsible, participate, benefit from, be privileged by things we didn't choose or intend or want.
Yeah.
That can be a really hard thing for us white people to deal with.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I think that, and again, that all the defense mechanisms that you mentioned earlier, I think it's just helpful to be aware of those things, right? There can be a anger at knowing this, excuses at how I didn't choose this. Or sometimes this debilitating guilt about, oh, I can't even live now.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what, like, because I can't live with this self-image. I can't live with the knowledge that I participate in these things without even trying.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's like too much. Too much for me.
Yeah, it's too much. So getting back to Bob's question then, we vacillate between doing nothing or going like a radical. Mm-hmm. Two, we sometimes people argue with the way Bob frames this, that he actually has a question to ask here because Bob wasn't alive when the GI Bill was passed, et cetera, et cetera. And three, what does it look like then to walk through something that's morally complicated?
Yeah.
Right? In a way that's faithful. Now, the reason I'm really glad or excited about Bob's question is because I think Bob's question is not unique to Bob's situation.
Yes.
As you pointed out earlier, Ben, about your clothes, and we talked about technology or whatever, almost every decision we make has this kind of moral complexity involved to it. We don't tend to it or appreciate it or name it as such.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, that's why I think even the fact that Bob is asking this question, it gets to the, like, I appreciate it as well, because he's basically sifted through those layers already. Even to ask the question is for him to open himself up, right? To, like, I don't know what this means. Like, I might feel like I need to make a costly choice here, you know?
Yeah.
And he's really wanting to discern it. And so I'm with you. I think I appreciate the question. And I think it does. It helps us maybe open ourselves up to, maybe there's questions, you know, that have been hanging around the edges of our mind that we haven't really wanted to think about because of, you know, again, the concerns about purity, or it just feels overwhelming and I wouldn't know what to say or do, that kind of thing. But I think crossing that bridge of actually asking the question and saying, well, what do we do? How do we live? I think that's a key, it's a key practice for what it will look like to follow Jesus in our in our day and age.
Yep. And so we could get into the history of the GI Bill here. I don't know if that's if you're curious about what that is. It's just a post World War II legislation that was passed that enabled primarily white returning soldiers to get education, access to mortgages, et cetera. And that same federal program wasn't available to returning black and brown soldiers.
Yes.
And so then, and there's another, that's an entire podcast, but that's all you're getting. Another entire podcast then is how generational wealth is built and how that's so vital in our political economy. And how the fact that and wealth that the generational wealth gap between black and brown people today in the United States is still between them and white people is still incredibly unjust, or we could say wide, and often that gap or inequality in like generational wealth is explained by blaming black people for it.
Yeah.
And what Bob is indicating is, and we're only talking about the GI Bill, we could talk about redlining. There's so many other things we could talk about that have contributed to a white person coming home and inheriting $50,000 from a grandfather that often isn't the case for a black family or a brown family. Just isn't. Yes. We could talk about that as well. We don't have time to talk about that as well, but Bob is alluding to that, and I want to name that as a big issue.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those, again, didn't have anything to do with it personally and, you know, volitionally, but definitely has, created conditions that are unjust that we participate in.
Yeah. You know? The third thing I'm not going to name is that, like, throughout history, throughout the U.S. history, the GI Bill is one of dozens and dozens and dozens of examples where the federal government created social services to benefit white people, white middle class and poor people, to give them economic help when they needed it most. It was widely supported and celebrated when it happened. Now the conversation is different. Not only is there a remythologizing of the past, you know, that the greatest generation did all their good work because of they just had lots of energy to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, et cetera. There's a remythologizing of the cowboy, of the prairie farmer, et cetera, that all these people thrived with no government assistance and just being independent, you know, heroes and warriors, figuring it out on the frontier. All of this is mythological. Mm-hmm. It's a myth. It's a story we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
We tell ourselves in order to valorize something that may have existed in very small ways for very certain people, but for the vast majority of us, throughout history, white people benefited from white social services that offered them government handouts because they needed it. Yeah. Right? So there's also a podcast about how about continues today, and social services continue for really, really wealthy people, billionaires, getting, you know, interest-free loans or government subsidies or government contracts, et cetera, et cetera. But then those same opportunities or social services offered to poor middle-class people are demonized as un-American. Yeah. And what's un-American is having no social services for poor middle-class people because they've always been there. And they've been a huge help, as Bob is describing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we don't have time to talk about that.
So I trust everybody will forget all of that stuff.
All that stuff.
No, that's all in the background. And I think all of that stuff, it's actually worth naming. I mean, we can't explain it all or sort of like unpack it all, but all of that is likely what goes into Bob's question and why he's even asking the question is he's aware of all this stuff. He's aware of all of these systems of privilege and also injustice that he is a direct beneficiary of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 So then having said all this, I think I want to go back to our chapter from Having the Mind of Christ, Ben. Chapter 7.
Which is a book we wrote.
Yeah, we wrote a book called Having the Mind of Christ.
Yeah.
You
can find it anywhere fine books are sold.
Hobby Lobby? Is it on the rack at Hobby Lobby?
I don't think the Christian they sell books at Hobby Lobby, do they?
I'm going to drop. They do. They got a little rack of Christian books.
Oh, it's probably not there.
Like
definitely
Amish romance fiction and Zig Ziglar is probably in there.
Okay.
Max Lucado.
Okay.
Not there, but other places you can
probably
find
it. Probably not there, but other bookstores.
My forthcoming Amish romance fiction novel will be there, though.
Yes.
Let's keep moving. One of the axioms that we've podcasted through and is in the book is God's love always reckons with power.
Right.
And I think one of the things we're going to talk about in our upcoming Mammon Learning Community and the Gravity Commons is that Mammon is power. That one of the reasons why Jesus talks about Mammon or wealth, as you can't serve both God and the word he uses there is Mammon, wealth, is because it asserts dominion. It has power.
Yeah.
It has a logic that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, or it creates a kingdom that is contrary or in opposition to the kingdom of God, right? I kind of lost my train of thought. Ben, I rabbit trailed myself into a vacuum. God's love always reckons with power. So money is a power, so we have to reckon with it. We learn how to do that from Jesus. So Jesus reckoned with power in three ways. He recognized it, right? Then he redistributed power as he redefined what power is.
Yeah.
And he did this, and I'm not just talking about like control of an organization power or leadership. I'm talking about social status, right? And how he would operate. Yeah. So I think then that gives us a model. We can pattern our response off of how we see Jesus inhabiting broken, unjust, social, economic, religious systems, participating in them while acting in ways that undo the injustice.
Yeah. Yes. I think there's an invitation here into some subtlety and to some creativity, even kind of being a trickster in some ways, like somebody who is in the system, you know, to use, but not of the system. Mm-hmm. Can become a trope in Christian circles, but actually I think there's a lot to it. There's a lot of wisdom in it of like, how do I, because, you know, Jesus, I just preached on this, so this is on my mind, but like Jesus was constantly, especially in the Gospel of Mark, critiquing the temple system, right? As unjust. It you know, robs widows of their houses, right? He's constantly critiquing it, but he's also participating in it. He goes to the mm-hmm. temple to pray. He teaches in the temple courts. Like he's participating, but there's a creative way that he's participating. And so I think that's what I'm hearing. And what you're saying is like, there's this invitation to figure out how to do that in our modern political economy.
Yeah.
You know, with inheritance money, right, for example. Right.
Right.
So yeah.
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 Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, some of the things that come to mind for me, like I feel that instinct for purity. Like I want to extricate myself from the system to maintain my own purity. But I've been surprised at sometimes like the voices of, it's usually Black women that say something different about that. Like I was remembering this article that we linked to in the curated links, which is, we send out every Friday, just a list of anybody who's in the community or on our email list. Mm-hmm. We send out these links, and I was struck by this article that somebody that I was not familiar with, I think her name is Sherilyn Eiffel. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. Anyway, it's an article that you can check out. I'll put this in the show notes as well. That's just an article titled The Truth, you know, What We Know Now. And it's basically just her encouragements for some practical things that we can do kind of in the wake of the election. And I was struck by this paragraph here. She says, I'll just read like a section here. Okay. If you litigate, do it with the expectation that you will win and act like it, show out, be excellent, and remain confident. Those who can still feel shame, whether those are your opponents at the opponent's table or those on the bench, will feel it when you hold the standard high, and your clients will never forget it. If you organize, never stop. Plant those seeds deep in the in our communities. If you hold office, hold it. Do not give up your power. Use your voice. Master every rule. Make a record. I repeat, make a record so that the truth might be known. And I guess as I was like, I was reading, like, do not give up your power. And I was just struck by, I think, the different instinct there than trying to maintain my own purity by extricating myself from the system versus staying in the system and using whatever privilege and power that I have on behalf of those who don't have it. So I think there's that's a different instinct. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a way of thinking about those things, in that way of like there's a difference in my mind between giving up my privilege and using my privilege on behalf of others. You know, like if you've got a platform, like to speak on behalf of those who don't have a platform, rather than just say, I shouldn't have a platform because other people don't have one. Does that make sense? Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things we've tried to do here is platform voices that are very critical of the tradition we come from.
Right.
As a way of making a reparation of truth,
mm-hmm.
which is some language I learned from Gregory Thompson and Duke Kwan in their book Reparation, that there's a truth telling.
Yes.
And that'll cost you. I don't know if you need that then.
Yeah.
It'll hit you in the pocketbook.
Often.
Yes. So then what does it mean then to not opt out totally?
Right.
So a few things to consider, right? you know, Bob mentioned using this money to purchase a house, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there is a, if the wrong done was that your grandfather got advantages that black returning soldiers didn't. Mm-hmm. One creative way to make a reparation with that money would be to seek out a black owned mortgage company and take out your mortgage through them. Mm-hmm. Seek out a black real estate agent and let them earn a commission off the sale. Put that $50,000 in a black owned bank. Mm-hmm. That is independent from, you know, the rapaciously awful national banks that we have in our country.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, so those are like three really basic ideas where the economic machinations around that money, you mm-hmm. could benefit people who didn't benefit from the initial giving of that money.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That would be a very practical way of, you know, redistribution of that power, right? From what you were talking about earlier, Matt, from our book, where there were practical ways that Jesus sought to redistribute that power because, mm-hmm. you know, there's probably several automatic ways of investing that money that would just contribute to, you know, only the system of injustice, but that way of thinking about it also then, yeah, it includes more people than it did initially.
Yeah.
And that would be, yeah, that would be a one way of thinking about that. You know, the other thing that I told Bob when he asked this question was that I was realizing that, you know, I've, you know, I didn't benefit directly from the GI Bill, but, you know, obviously benefited from being white in America. And you know, that has allowed us to buy homes. And we currently live in a home that we own, you know, we own this home. And I was just realizing how there is a power and a benefit to owning a home that gives you more of a sense of permanence than if you had to rent. And that is something that can be used for justice as well. You know, just the fact that I actually... you know, through the mortgage company, but actually own this place and have a sense and a level of permanence that allows me to perhaps do things that I couldn't do otherwise in terms of ministry and that kind of a thing. So
you just mentioned you're in a neighborhood association now that's mixed ethnicity, mm-hmm. mixed economics, right?
Yep.
White people and black people, you know, living close by, and mm-hmm. there's the city wants to put a bike lane through mm-hmm. On your street,
yeah,
which a lot of affluent, more white people would like because they want to bike places. But the people who've lived on your street a long time, some of them, the poorer black people, mm-hmm. the bike lane will take away their parking on the street. So they will have to then park somewhere farther away from their house because they don't have garages. Mm-hmm. And that is detrimental to them physically. Obviously, it's an inconvenience, but also some physically people, like they need to be close to their front door in order to, be mobile.
Right.
And so the money you spent put you in a place where you can care about something alongside people who typically don't have a more affluent white person caring about it with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I'm not talking about like a disempowering sort of like a colonial like a
paternalistic
benevolent.
Or something.
I'm gonna make this decision for you and you're gonna appreciate me. I'm talking just about like I'm the way that I spent my money put me in the way of having to carry this concern alongside my neighbors mm-hmm. that wouldn't have been in my way or concerned me had I not been here.
Yeah. Right. I think that's a good practical example of that. Yeah, that's a very real situation for us in our neighborhood right now. Yeah.
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 You know, I think there's a myriad ways that Bob could redistribute and with using this money. I think giving it all away or not caring at all often capture our imagination. And there's lots of creative things to do in between those two things. Mm-hmm. When we close, Ben, I know we've been chatting a while here. Listener, before we close, I just want to say if you have ideas or thoughts or reflections on this conversation, mm-hmm. maybe you're like, you know, screaming at your little radio. Because you probably listen to podcasts on radios.
On a radio, yes.
You're screaming
on the FM
at
dial.
You're screaming at the radio, saying, "Why haven't you said this? Or why don't you think about this? Or what about this question?" Please reach out to us and participate. We really are opening up. I mean, it could be a can of worms, but we're really opening up this conversation. And I'm sure there's things that we're missing. And so I'd love to learn from you and hear from you. But I want to. So anyway, podcast at gravitycommons.com. Just send us an email or, you can reach out through the, mm-hmm. Leaving us a voicemail too. But redefining power. I want to say this. I think it's difficult for someone who has the kind of power that $50,000 gives you. It's difficult for that person to redefine how money works.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Can I give you an example of how there is kind of a, I mean, I'm a part of Cost Plus, which is Mark Cuban's prescription savings program.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And without Cost Plus, I couldn't afford one of the prescriptions I take. Mm-hmm. But Mark Cuban can create, start, and fund this program because he's a billionaire. Mm-hmm. Because he's got lots and lots and lots of power. He can redefine for some people how the healthcare system works, right? Now, it's redistribution, but it's also giving access to certain prescriptions that only the wealthy can get. Another example of this is my nephew is at Harvard and got a scholarship from Bill Gates because Bill Gates started a scholarship program mm-hmm. for non-white students. He sponsors 200 non-white students a year to get basically room and board tuition paid for as much schooling as they want. Yeah. So he's a Gates scholar and Bill Gates will pay for my nephew's undergrad, grad, and whatever postdoc work he wants to do.
Incredible.
There's a access to education mm-hmm. and creating like the kinds of economic opportunities that, you know, up until recently, you know, advanced degrees would create is a way of redefining who gets access mm-hmm. to certain places where money can be made.
Right.
So I just bring up Bill Gates and Mark Cuban to say like they've got a lot of power and they're able to redefine it in ways that maybe Bob can't. You know, they're able to redefine like who gets to be at the table. You know, Jesus does this a lot because Jesus has an incredible amount of power, which is why he was killed. And he was able to spend his power on other people. In ways that sometimes it's more difficult for those of us with less power to do so. But I wonder, Ben, if you have thoughts about redefining here, if they differ with mine or they contrast with mine.
No, I think that is a point that I think is important for us to remember is that, we don't all have the same level of ability to redefine how power works, you know, how the economy works. And that's actually a really important aspect of this that I think, again, it flies in the face of our desire for purity, but it also is important, I guess, to reflect on like, what's the actual level of power and influence that I have to change things here? And, you know, how do I creatively participate in ways that do resist, you know, the worst aspects of, you know, mammon? And then, but what is mine to do and what's mine not to do, you know?
Yes.
Not all of us can do the same thing. And so, you know, this listener is, you know, again, at the end of the day, $50,000 is not nothing, but, you know, in the large scheme of the political economy we live in, it's actually not that much, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, you know, how do you right size your participation and figure out the, you know, the best way to, yeah, leverage the privilege that you have on behalf of justice.
Yeah.
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 In
so
practical ways. So
one of the ways that I think about, if we get smaller, you know, one of the ways I think about like redefining power is it's commonplace. So Ben and I co-pastor a church with another guy, and it's common in churches that people get asked to do a lot of work for a very little amount of money. This is common for anybody who's worked in a church. You get underpaid and you're overworked. And I've often thought—
Because it's for Jesus.
Yeah, because you should feel bad if you don't do it.
It's its own reward.
Yeah, you're going to get treasures in heaven, my brother. Mm-hmm. No, I've often thought I want to redefine that calculus, and I actually want to create a system that is able to compensate above that. Mm-hmm. So that no longer is the admin or the youth pastor, or the worship leader making almost nothing.
Right.
Right.
Market value. We don't think about market value.
No.
As much as we think about livable wage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's a for instance, right? Yeah. So I have, you and I and Spencer have a modicum of agency and dominion. We were responsible for this system that we're leading. How do we redefine how power works economically so that we don't take advantage or exploit? I know that's strong language. Yeah. We don't underpay people, but maybe we even overpay them. Mm-hmm. Which is even to frame it like that is how mammon works. Like how do we compensate people above what the system or the market
says they're worth
requires.
Yeah, yeah.
So those kinds of questions are front and center for me on redefining things, right? Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder if this conversation gives Bob an imagination for, are there ways to use this money I'm inheriting to create some kind of redefinition experiment?
Yeah.
I think that's...
Love it.
I think that's it. I just want to share one thing that I'm not going to talk about.
This is the fourth thing we're not going to talk about.
There is a parable that Jesus tells about the unjust steward. Remember this parable?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just read it in the Daily Office.
Who's cheating everybody. Yeah. And then his boss brings him in and says, you're fired. And then he goes and he changes how much in debt the people are, reduces their debt by an incredible amount. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, afterwards, Jesus is like, use ungodly wealth to make friends.
Yep.
Right? Now, I think the reason why we're not going to talk about this is I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this parable.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
But there's a shrewdness in inhabiting a system in a way that seems a little dubious, but it ends up undoing a larger injustice.
Yeah.
There's a way of being a trickster. Mm-hmm. In other words, think about the Hebrew midwives who are told to kill Hebrew babies by Pharaoh in Exodus. Mm-hmm. I think this is chapter 1 or 2. And then they don't. And then when Pharaoh comes to them and says, why aren't you killing the babies? And they're like, well, these Hebrew women, they squeeze them out so fast. We can't, I mean, they give birth before we can show up,
yeah.
Right? Which is a blatant lie,
right?
We're kind of told the text kind of indicates they're lying. Mm-hmm. But they're lying in order to prevent infanticide.
Right.
And so they're sort of inhabiting a system that's thoroughly unjust, mm-hmm. and being tricksters in that system for righteousness.
Yeah.
And I this is also where our guilt, innocence frame, the tight frame, doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
Because the midwives are both guilty and innocent.
Right.
Right? Yeah. And I think that as we learn to inhabit systems that are dominated by mammon, mm-hmm. we need to experience the freedom to experiment, to create creative, scandalous almost yeah. experiments of being tricksters.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that story. Say. Yeah. I love that story because this is just us talking more about the thing that we're not going to talk about. Mm-hmm. I love that story, the parable that you mentioned, because Jesus does this in several different places where it's almost like this is a phrase that Jacques Ellul uses, that he profanes money. Hmm. He profanes the power of money. Hmm. So in that story, it seems dishonest to us to be like, oh gosh, that, you know, that person owed 400, you know, jugs of olive oil,
yeah.
and the guy just made it 200. Like, he's stealing from his master.
Yes.
But there is a sense in which that, like, Jesus is almost treating that sense of debt that feels holy to us. Like, you cannot mess with that debt. Like, and Jesus is like, well, why not? Like, why not? You know, like he's profaning money in a way. And I think he does this when, you know, they ask him about the coin. Should we pay taxes? Like, part of what Jesus' answer is profaning the money. He's like, whose image is on this? Like, give Caesar his little trinkets. Who cares? You know, like, don't treat this as such a big deal, as such a holy thing as you are. Like, Jesus has a way of profaning money. And I think that's the invitation I hear in here as well, of being a trickster, is like, how do we learn to question the sort of almost like reverence that we're taught to have toward money? How do we treat it as like, it's just like, how do we begin to profane the power of money in the way that we treat it?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the ways we do that is begin to identify where we make competition holy.
Yeah.
And profit holy.
Right.
And we equate value with getting the most for the least amount of money.
Yeah.
Like, all of those three things I just said, if we could begin to identify where we think competition is the answer to some sort of societal problem, where we see profit as the fundamental driving force that we organize decisions around, mm-hmm. and we stop equating value with getting the most for the least.
Yeah.
Like, these are all the, when I talk about the logic of mammon, common sense, mm-hmm. that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
And there's more, but those are like three huge ones. Anyway, yeah. that's all the time we have today, folks. That's yeah. it. There's so much more to chat about. Obviously, we mm-hmm. dealt with like history things here and economic things here. But Bob, hopefully this is helpful for you. I thought your question was the question we always have to be asking. Like, yes. it's good. Unique and particular to the situation, but literally we're confronted with this question every day. And yes. so hopefully this has contributed to spurring on more conversation and thoughts and creativity as we learn how to live faithfully in Babylon.
Amen.
Amen.
All right. We'll see you next time, listeners.
See you.
Well, see you. We'll, mm-hmm. anyway, hopefully you tune into the next episode to be practically. We won't see each other at all. So, peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.